Sub-Saharan Africa's population is booming, and it'll soon have one of the largest labor forces in the world.
So this large influx of working age people in need of jobs that are not there, that creates certainly the sense of dissatisfaction.
And where better to express that dissatisfaction than in the ballot box?
It is indeed a big election year. We have 19 elections, I think, this year, and then another 9 scheduled next year. What's one thing we don't discuss enough is the possibility that an election might actually produce a fresh mandate for change.
Hi, I'm Venji Chen. I'm the Deputy Division Chief of the Regional Studies Division in the African Department. I'm also the Mission Chief to Mali.
I'm Andrew Tiffin, also a Deputy Division Chief in the Regional Studies Division in the African Department and Mission Chief for Lesotho.
Venji Chen and Andrew Tiffin are behind the latest economic outlook for Sub-Saharan Africa, which looks at some of the reforms that might help improve prospects for the region. So this regional outlook zeroes in on some of the long-standing issues which we've talked about in previous podcasts over the years, like debt levels and imbalances, the need for fiscal consolidation, etc. And I find it interesting how this report essentially kicks off by saying that these issues do persist, but not because governments aren't trying. Why has it proven so difficult to implement reforms in Sub-Saharan Africa?
So I'd perhaps reframe that. I think it's difficult to implement reforms everywhere.
Okay.
I guess, you know, one of the themes of the world economic outlook is right now we are in a low growth, high debt environment, and that's sort of an environment where reforms, especially structural reforms, are one of the key things that we look for. And it's not easy anywhere. For Sub-Saharan Africa, I think difference is in the circumstances that they're facing right now. We've just come out of 4 years of crisis. Fiscal and external buffers have been reduced at a household level. The household balance sheets have also been stretched. So in general, authorities, households find themselves with fewer options and harder trade-offs. And that's where the region is right now. Now, in our report, we sort of identify 3 main hurdles. What's getting in the way of easy implementation of reforms right now? The first is just slow growth. We do have overall a very slow growth across the region. It's 3.6% right now. Flat, it was 3.6% last year. The second is that the funding squeeze that we mentioned in a number of previous reports, that's still ongoing.
Yeah.
And the third point would be just the cumulative impact of all this 4 years of stress and difficulty, the impact of that on political stability and social unrest, which has just made these decisions much more fraught and difficult.
Right. And so obviously jobs is an issue, has been an issue for quite some time, but that whole thing is picking up steam given that the region will soon become one of the largest labor forces in the world. And the report talks about the need to sort of bring more economic activity into the formal sector to address the employment issues. I guess the question is, why is informality so strong in so many of those countries? And why is it a problem in terms of creating more jobs?
Yes, so in one of our notes accompanying the conjunctural chapter, we indeed talk about the clock is ticking and the absolute need to create more jobs. Now, informality is indeed very widespread in the region. And one of the most obvious reasons, because there is a lack of formal jobs. So people are really, by circumstances, pushed into the informal sector. Mm-hmm. And what we found in our analysis is that in Sub-Saharan Africa, the countries generate far fewer formal jobs compared to other emerging market and developing countries outside of the region. In fact, the region produces only about 1/3 of the formal jobs you would see elsewhere with similar increases in income. Now, informality in itself is not a big problem.
Not necessarily,
exactly. If we think that it is a stepping stone towards better type of jobs. So what am I talking about? You can think about a street vendor, for instance, selling fruits. That could be a very good example of an informal job where there are no social contracts, no safety net, no health insurance associates. So if there were to be a shock by a disaster, or if that person would fall sick, there would be no fallback option. So that would be a trap for that person. But if you were to think in a better case scenario, that person selling fruits could expand his or her business, get into agro-processing and expand the number of employees, that would be a great outcome and maybe a way to turn into formal private sector growth. But that is something we see lacking in the region. And there are lots of obstacles that we identified in terms of why private businesses, while they get created, don't actually grow as we like them envisioning. And many of the obstacles are the lack of financing in particular, the shortages of electricity. When you run a business, you need to have lights on. And also the red tape in order to create your business. Yeah. So all those things are really not in favor for the many, many people. And we're estimating about 15 million people annually that are in need of jobs between now and 2030.
Wow. And, you know, speaking of jobs, natural resources have always been a big source of employment for the region. I mean, especially in oil. But it seems that these resource exporting countries are struggling a little bit these days. And the report, I think, shows that the growth rates in these countries are almost half of what they are in other countries. So why is it that, you know, these countries that were once essentially the economic powerhouses of the region are now dragging behind?
Yeah, I think if you look at growth across the region, that's one of the most striking findings that immediately leaps out at you, that overall, if you look at the region as a whole, sub-Saharan Africa looks like the rest of the world right now, where we've just characterized growth across the world as stable but underwhelming.
Right.
That's certainly the same case in sub-Saharan Africa. But if you look a bit deeply and look at different countries, there's a pattern that immediately leaps out, is that we have some countries that are growing really, really well. I think it's in the world's top 20 fastest growing economies, almost half of those are from sub-Saharan Africa. Okay, so there is a group of countries that are actually doing really well. Then there's another group who are not doing so well. And these are, for the most part, are countries that are concentrated on, where their economic activity is concentrated on the extraction of resources.
Right.
So this is something that we look into in a bit of detail in one of our analytical notes associated with this the cycles are released. And the first thing that you find is that this was not always the case. We did not always have this two-track growth path. In fact, up until 2015, as you mentioned, these countries were actually the powerhouse of the region. They were growing really well. They were growing faster than non-resource intensive countries. But then we had 2015, where we had a global commodity price shock, where commodities as a whole fell by about 40%, oil in particular fell by more than half. So countries that were not as focused on resource extraction, they managed to keep on going, growing at a fairly high rates. It's the countries that were focused on resources. Investment and growth in these countries never really recovered following this shock, after this drop in income. As part of the note, we try and dig down into why that happens. And to a certain extent, no two countries are the same, and so no two resource-focused countries are the same. But one pattern that does emerge is that the countries that fared the worst are those that had pre-existing weaknesses in their institutions. Things like a lack of transparency, an overall lack of transparency with the government, a rigid and unfair business environment, the presence of corruption, all these things interact with a large shock to income, to depress investment and to stifle growth and to prevent the investment that would be needed to help dig these countries out of the hole that they're in. And that's what we've seen for the past decade, that these countries have been on this low-level path ever since that one shock.
Yeah. All right. So the transition, I mean, move to maybe a little on climate change here, and the transition to renewable energy that is being pushed by climate change problems is showing some promise for the region in terms of the minerals that are required to make that transition. But climate change itself is reaping havoc across, you know, sub-Saharan Africa in many ways. How can countries mitigate some of the risks associated with climate change? And I'm interested in hearing what the fund or how the fund can help countries do that.
Yes, as you mentioned, I think it's very important to note that the sub-Saharan Africa region is one of the most affected by climate change in terms of the disasters, the frequency and the magnitude of them hitting those countries. And despite actually the region contributing the least to right. greenhouse gas emissions. So, for instance, we've seen in southern Africa the recent droughts that were very, very catastrophic for, yeah. for food insecurity, and also the recent flooding in Western Africa that really impacted many people in terms of displacement, in terms of food security as well. And those types of catastrophes have longer lasting consequences. It's also in terms of the most vulnerable that are mostly being affected by those. And those are the ones that will have more consequences in the future, even after the drought is passed or the flood itself has gone. Now, what can countries themselves do? I think on sub-Saharan Africa, we look mostly into climate change adaptation. Mm-hmm. And this, again, comes first and foremost in terms of agricultural production, looking at, for instance, climate-resistant or resilient agricultural projects and practices, mm-hmm. as well as drought-resistant in the southern African regions. And at the same time, as I mentioned, the most vulnerable people being hit, looking at how to enhance social protection, having targeted policies, cash transfers in times of food insecurity would be very, very important for the governments as well to implement those. And lastly, of course, but not exclusively, also looking at disaster risk management right. in terms of foretelling when disasters are coming, in terms of forecasting events, etc. But also for the region, for countries that are close to each other to regionally cooperate with each other to work together in terms of food imports, exports that one country can help out during a time when another country is facing difficulties. And I think it's very important to remember that the international community has a big role to play
yeah.
in terms of lending a hand here, again, as the region is so impacted but has relatively little contributed in terms of the emissions themselves. Now, we at the IMF, of course, mm-hmm. stand ready to do our part. And since December 2022, we have instituted the Resilience and Sustainability Facility, the RSF, yeah. and 11 countries in the region are already part of this. And it's a new financing instrument that looks into assisting these countries in terms of addressing long-term structural challenges mm-hmm. Arising from climate change, but also from the pandemic, for instance, and looking into efforts to support adaptation, mitigation, and also really to look at catalyzing what we call how to right. attract private financing and investment into the region. Now, apart from these lending efforts that we have done, we also give policy advice where we have now incorporated climate change advice into our macroeconomic framework and policy mm-hmm. Advice that we give. And last, another big pillar is our capacity development. Mm-hmm. And so, in summary, these countries yeah. are really on our radar okay. in terms of climate change.
So that's training when we're talking about capacity development. It's exactly. essentially training. And you mentioned the most vulnerable people in countries that are extremely vulnerable to climate change, especially. They're also dealing with conflict and fragility. And of course, climate change is exacerbating that as well. But again, jobs, to what extent is the lack of employment contributing to the instability in many of these countries?
Yes. So the research that we have done also in conjunction with this chapter, it has shown that high levels of poverty, inequality, and social exclusion, mm-hmm. which can be also be factors from not having stable employment, those tend to be key contributors, in fact, to social and internal conflicts. And so this limited access to basic services that arise in terms of the needs, not having jobs and predictable income, but on top of that, the perceptions of corruption and regovernance, those all heighten the sense of social frustration in the yeah. area that can lead to social tensions. And in particular, with the demographic trends that we see, many of these countries and the region is undoubtedly going to be the youngest yeah. out of anywhere in the world. So this large influx of working age people in need of jobs that are not there, that yeah. that creates certainly the sense of dissatisfaction.
Yeah. So this is also the time of year, Andrew, that the WEO comes out, the World Economic mm-hmm. Outlook, and so we've been hearing a lot about increasing uncertainties, mm-hmm. volatility in markets, yeah. the continuing slowdown in China. Mm-hmm. How much does all that play into this economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa?
So if you just look at the recent past, right, the impact of where the global economy is on our region, right, that impact is actually clear. The past few years has been very, very difficult for the global economy. There have been shocks to growth. There's been slowing trade. There's been higher inflation, higher volatility in financial markets, and higher global interest rates and borrowing costs. And all that has weighed on growth and the outlook for our region. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons that growth is relatively disappointing right now.
Yeah.
But looking forward, again, drawing from the Rio, there are some positive signs that we're also looking at. We have managed to engineer a relatively soft landing. Inflation is coming down, which has allowed interest rates also to come down, which should help with borrowing costs and growth for our region. Mm-hmm. But we're not out of the woods yet. Borrowing costs are still very high.
Yeah.
Also, there's still a lot of uncertainty, and we see this uncertainty across a range of markets, especially in financial markets. And the one thing that does stand out for sub-Saharan Africa is that uncertainty has an outsized impact on the region. Shifts in global sentiment tend to hit hardest those countries that are seen as relatively more risky. Unfortunately, that includes a number of countries in our region.
Right. And finally, going back to this idea of the difficulty in implementing reforms, mm-hmm. This year has been a big election year for the region. There have been several big elections. And the report suggests that, this might present an opportunity to get things done. Mm-hmm. Do you see, the political landscape being more conducive to reforms in the near future, perhaps?
I think, yes. This is one thing that we also explore in the report. I mean, it is indeed a big election year. We have 19 elections, I think, this year, and then another 9 scheduled next year. So very sort of active period. Now, a lot of times discussions of elections are usually sort of somewhat downbeat. One of the emphases mm-hmm. is that coming up to an election, governments are reluctant to do anything bold or anything that might upset people. So there's a sense that elections are one of the factors that stifle reform. But there's another side to that, right? One thing we don't discuss enough is the possibility that an election might actually produce a fresh mandate for change, provide a window of opportunity that allows the authorities to actually take action in a way that they have not been able to do before. Now, this is something we also explore in our report. In structural reform, of course, the electoral consequences of a bold reform are relatively new for a new government, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we have a reform where action is needed up front in the short term, but benefits only turn up in the long term, okay, if you're a new government and you have an extended period ahead of you, mm-hmm. you're much more likely to want to do that reform.
That's right.
Also on fiscal adjustment, the empirical evidence suggests that following an election, 3 years after an election, countries are much more likely to engage in fiscal adjustment. Okay, this is true worldwide, but it's particularly the case in sub-Saharan Africa, where that impact of a fresh election and a mandate for change is actually twice as large as we see elsewhere. And we're starting to see some of this play out, say, an example in South Africa, right, where we just had fresh elections. The new government did seem to run with a new mandate for change, and we've seen immediate impacts of that on confidence and our indicators of where the economy is going and the outlook. Borrowing costs have dropped by 200 basis points. The exchange rate has appreciated, which has allowed inflation to come down much more rapidly than we had anticipated before, which has then allowed the South African Central Bank to start easing policy. And this cycle, we hope, will be self-reinforcing because growth allows for more reform, which allows for greater credibility, greater confidence, which allows for more growth, and so on and so on and so on.
More stability.
There is the potential of a virtuous cycle going ahead just from taking advantage of an opportunity for change, taking advantage of that mandate for change.
Well, let's hope that we see more of that across the region in this in the post-electoral periods. Andrew Tiffin and Benji Chen, both economists in the IMF's Africa Department and work on the regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You'll find the latest regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.